We're talking deep freeze. Today, January 6th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A polar vortex descends over much of North America, and they're feeling it way down south.
If you're an alligator in the swamp, you may want to bundle up.
For some perspective, though, we go to Yellowknife in Canada, where the locals know a thing or two about sub-zero temperatures.
Frostbite is pretty much a common occurrence up here because it can happen in as little as 2 minutes if you're outside, so really avoiding that exposed skin is the way to go.
Also, a look ahead to the big stories likely to come out of China in 2014, and a veteran Mideast correspondent offers this somber assessment of the region in the new year.
It seems like 2014 is heading south really quickly.
All of that, plus we remember Eusebio, one of soccer's all-time greats. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We've got a packed program for you today, from the latest on the conflict in South Sudan to an update from Iraq and a look ahead at what China will be up to in the year ahead. Not to mention remembering a Mozambican athlete who went on to become one of the greatest soccer players ever. But first, we've got to start with what everyone's talking about at the frozen water cooler. I'm talking the frigid weather, the polar vortex that's slowly enveloping much of America today. Already feeling the effects in Wisconsin is Eric Holthaus. He reports on the weather for Quartz.
I wanted to test a little thing that I saw on YouTube this morning. So I boiled up a pot of water, walked outside for about 20 seconds, which is about all I could handle, and tossed it into the air, and it instantly turned into snow. So
that works.
Cold. Yeah. I wouldn't have believed that it would have worked until I actually saw it with my own eyes.
It's pretty cold there, I guess we can say. Now, this polar vortex, as it's called, is pretty far reaching from what I've seen, going down as far south as Alabama.
Actually, South Florida in the Everglades has issued a freeze watch. So if you're an alligator in the swamp, you may want to bundle up.
So give us the science here. I mean, where is this Arctic blast coming from and why is it happening now?
What's going on really is that sharp contrast between warm and cold. We're on the East Coast right now. It's in the 50s and 60s. And behind that cold front, it's as cold as minus 40. There's a really strong low pressure center that's literally wrapping cold air down all the way from Greenland into basically as far south as Florida.
Is there any connection between these really cold temperatures, what they're calling a polar blast, and global warming?
The latest science is still not totally bulletproof, but there's a theory that's been gaining traction in the last year or two that the melting ice in the Arctic is actually shifting the jet stream farther north, making it a little bit weaker, and therefore making it a little bit wavier, making it more likely for one of these waves to become super elongated like it is today, pulling cold air as far south as we're seeing.
What do you make of that Arctic ice melt theory?
I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, if the mechanism behind the jet stream is weakening, the difference in temperature between the poles and the tropics, the Arctic is warming at a rate twice as fast as the rest of the world. So when you see that temperature difference decreasing a little bit, if you believe, you know, meteorological science, the jet stream should weaken and all these effects should happen, which are the exact effects that we're seeing.
So aside from making snow with a tea kettle, how are you coping with the cold, Eric?
Well, it's funny. We got about 5 chickens about a month ago, and we were really worried that they were going to not do well outside. Incredibly, we read that, you know, they could be okay in temperatures as cold as 20 below, and we didn't want to risk it, so we have them in our basement right now. But so it's been kind of hard to sleep last night with all the chicken noises, but other than that, I think we're doing okay.
And what about the nuts who went out in seriously sub-zero weather to watch the Green Bay Packers yesterday? Are they really the kind of people we want as cold weather role models?
Well, you know, as long as they're enjoying themselves, I mean, I'm not that crazy, but go right ahead.
Eric Holthaus there in Wisconsin, where he reports on all things weather for Quartz. This polar vortex weather may come as a shock to many of us in the lower 48, but there are places north of the border where frigid temperatures are normal. Christy Kleimenhage lives in such a place and knows about extreme cold. She's a meteorologist for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. In fact, she works for CBC North. She's based in Yellowknife, the capital of the Northwest Territories. So, Christy, welcome. Is CBC North like the extreme sports version of weathercasting?
It's definitely a challenge at times. I'm the only meteorologist in the North, so I see it all from blizzards to minus 50 degree temperatures. All of it comes into me.
Wow. So what's the weather like today in Yellowknife?
Today, it's actually not too bad. It's only looking like minus 25 Celsius. So that puts you at around minus 14 Fahrenheit. The temperatures that we saw last week in the area in Yellowknife, we saw temperatures as low as minus 48 degrees Fahrenheit. So Very cold conditions.
Right. So we've got just here in Boston in this past weekend, they did not go as low as that. But I heard a lot of stories about burst pipes. Basic issues like that, how do you deal with it?
It's definitely a common occurrence here. You just have to realize that when temperatures get that low, you're constantly either running the hot water through the pipes or trying to keep your car as warm as possible, starting it every couple hours or so. So it's definitely a different mind frame you have to get into when it's that cold to keep your things functioning.
How do you avoid frostbite or other health issues due to exposure?
Well, frostbite is pretty much a common occurrence up here because it can happen in as little as 2 minutes if you're outside. So really avoiding that exposed skin is the way to go. I mean, when I go outside, I'm putting not just two layers, but about four or five on and making sure that nothing's actually showing it to the outside world or else it'll freeze up.
I know there are some hidden dangers as well that people down here, like even in Boston, we don't think about. You drop your keys to the car, for example. Mm-hmm. Do not pick them up with a naked hand, right?
Oh, no, it'll definitely burn. It'll feel like touching probably a hot iron. it's definitely painful. It's funny when you get to these temperatures, it's that cold period when you're feeling chilly doesn't happen. It's immediate from feeling fine to pain to not feeling pain, which is the bad one because that's when you're trying to get back inside and things are starting to freeze up.
For transportation, which is a big nightmare for everybody, whether mm-hmm. they're in trains, planes, or automobiles, you're a pilot. Mm-hmm. How do you fly when it's so cold? And are there certain temperatures where you just won't fly?
Well, I'm a recreational pilot, so I definitely can go when I want or not go. So if it gets below certain temperatures, like if it gets below minus 27, minus 28 Fahrenheit, I won't go. It's just too cold. But it's interesting because as long as you're in the air, temperatures from minus 15 Fahrenheit to minus 20, they're actually gorgeous flying conditions. It's like flying through silk. It's very smooth and stable. So it's really nice once you get in the air. But that being said, it can cause some problems with the plane on the ground. Lots of more technical problems in the winter. You can have tires going flat or popping or things, instruments freezing up on you. So once your plane's warmed up and you can get in the air, it's actually beautiful. But I know that it causes lots of problems for people on the ground and mechanically wise.
What kind of parka do you wear? Downfilled or poly?
I wear a Canada Goose, so a downfilled jacket, and it keeps me nice and warm.
Keeping it local.
Yeah,
good.
Gotta do it.
Christy Kleiman-Haga, meteorologist with CBC North in Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories. Thank you and stay warm.
Thank you, you as well.
Reporter Deepak Singh is hunkering down at his home in Indiana today, but it turns out it's pretty cold in his home country of India, too. Okay, relatively cold. Deepak has this essay.
In my decade of living in the United States, extreme weather seems to follow me wherever I move. Hurricanes and tornadoes, I've seen it all. And right now, it's the cold. Today, I'm sitting inside my home in South Bend, Indiana, watching the local TV forecast. According to the weatherman, we are seeing record-breaking temperatures in this area, negative 14 degrees Fahrenheit. With wind chill, it feels like minus 44. After so many years in America, I still don't understand Fahrenheit. I converted it to Celsius. My calculator said minus 42, so I called my mother in Lucknow to share this with her. When I asked her what she was doing, she told me she was warming her hands over an angiti, a wood stove. She said, "It's very cold and the power is out. We are not in America like you. No central heating here." The angiti brought to mind my childhood days in India. We always had a wood stove in our home during winter months. I would invite my friends and we'd huddle around the stove and roast potatoes in the pit and talk and laugh over silly things. I told my mother that it's going to be very cold today in Indiana. So cold that water pipes freeze and people could die of hypothermia, even frostbite. She said, "It's only 6 degrees Celsius. And people are already dying of cold in India. Just don't go out and wear enough clothes. You're in America. You'll be fine."
Mother always knows best. That's reporter Deepak Singh, staying indoors in South Bend, Indiana. The fighting in South Sudan continues, despite ongoing peace talks between the government and rebels. On the ground, though, the future of the world's newest country is still threatened by a conflict that's tinged with ethnic strife. The BBC's James Copnell is just back from South Sudan's capital, Juba.
Although the fighting broke out there on December the 15th, actually Juba has been relatively calm for several days now, more than a couple of weeks. And the fighting has spread throughout the country. In particular, the rebels have been able to take control of the town of Bor and the town of Bentiu.
What's the feeling like on the ground there in Juba compared with, you know, you leave, a couple score miles outside the capital and you're into some fairly hairy territory?
Yes, look, I mean, you can still find some pretty terrifying stories in Juba, in particular in the camps around the UN bases. There are a couple of them in town where there are more than 20,000 people who've gone to seek refuge, and people telling stories of them and their families being targeted based on their ethnic group, they said, and horrifying stories of people being killed and fleeing bullets to get to the relative safety of the UN compound. But there's no doubt that the situation is much worse elsewhere in the country.
Now, you said as for those refugees who have flooded into Juba, some of them told you they were targeted based on what ethnicity they belonged to. Did they describe anything to you that sounded like ethnic cleansing?
I think ethnic cleansing is a very strong word and probably one for the lawyers to decide on. But certainly I think there's ample evidence that people have been targeted based on their ethnicity. And it's a very complicated issue because South Sudan, this crisis here, is essentially a political crisis that has since taken on, in part, an ethnic dimension. And that's because politicians have ethnic power bases. So Nuer people, which is the same ethnic group as the former vice president now leading the rebellion, many of them say they were targeted in Juba in the early days of the crisis. And Dinka, which is the ethnic group of the South Sudanese president Salva Kiir, they say that they have been targeted elsewhere in the country by Nuer intent on revenge. So there is an ethnic dimension to this, and the United Nations and human rights groups have called for an end to these ethnic attacks. But it's certainly not the only thing, the only explanation, or even a sufficient explanation for what's happening in South Sudan.
I mean, rebels are now using the same guerrilla tactics the government once used to gain independence. I mean, is there any hope for a peace process with all this brutality going on?
Well, South Sudan has a very tragic history. So before it became independent in 2011, there were two very long-running civil wars with Khartoum when South Sudan was part of the then United Sudan. And more than 2 million people died in those two conflicts, it's estimated. But what that history shows is not only the division and the fighting, but also that in the end, peace deals are possible and reconciliation is possible to an extent at any rate. So things look pretty bleak right now. That said, there's substantial international pressure on both sides to agree to a cessation of hostilities at any rate, a halt to the fighting to allow talks to take place in a more conducive atmosphere. But they will also have to deal with the greater political issues too, and that could take a lot of time and a lot of energy, and it's going to require the commitment of both sides to come to an agreement. And that does seem difficult at the moment because both have quite entrenched positions, and both, I think, will be looking closely to the military balance on the floor, on the field. And as that switches, so too does the strength of the relative negotiating positions.
The BBC's James Copnell, who has just returned from South Sudan. Thank you for your time, James.
Thank you.
Still ahead on the world, Iraqis and Syrians take on al-Qaeda on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. What happens when a country's highest court decides to revoke the citizenship of thousands of its citizens? That's what the Constitutional Court in the Dominican Republic decided to do last September. The ruling mostly affects Dominicans of Haitian descent who had an ancestor who came over without legal papers. The decision, not surprisingly, has strained relations with the country's closest neighbor, Haiti. And as Amy Brackett reports, it's just as controversial inside the Dominican Republic.
It's a Monday evening in the coastal city of Barahona. Residents hang around the city's central Arco de Triunfo, the Grand Arch. It's in the middle of a noisy rotary. Mario Matos Cuevas sits on a park bench. He's an 81-year-old retired soldier. I ask him what he thinks of the Constitutional Court decision, or what people here simply call la sentencia. The sentencia is very controversial and has attracted the attention of the whole world, he says. But, according to the president of the Dominican Republic, everyone in every country in the world needs to legalize themselves. So our president has been very clear, very explicit, that everyone must get their papers in order. But isn't it unfair, I ask, to make people who lived in the country for generations go back and apply for papers all over again? No, he says. According to the Haitian Constitution, anyone of Haitian descent, whether legal or illegal, living in any country is Haitian. That's what their constitution says. But then a man sitting in a plastic chair nearby calls us over, and he tells us he opposes the sentencia.
Our country must have control over its immigration, like every country in the world. It's essential. But it cannot be that someone born on this land, in this country, is not Dominican. That's incredible. It's stupid.
That's Julio Valenzuela. He's from Barahona, but lived in Miami for 20 years. I ask him if he thinks the court decision comes out of discrimination against Haitians, who in general have darker skin than Dominicans. He says no.
Saying I live in your country.
When I was in your country, some rednecks would yell at me, "Hey, get out of here." But here, I've never heard a Dominican person say, "Hey, Haitian, get out of here." Never.
On the other side of the Arco de Triunfo is a high school where students are filing out of afternoon classes. One of them is David de la Paz. I ask him about the sentencia.
People born in one country shouldn't be deported to another country because they wouldn't know that country. Those born here must not be sent away because that would cause too much suffering.
I ask his friend Eduardo San Pedro if he's concerned about the sentencia. He hesitates before answering. So De La Paz turns to him and starts making it personal.
Let me tell you something. You know I'm Haitian, right? What if they came for me, even though I'm from here, and you know it? What if they came and deported me? Even though you and I have lived here side by side our whole lives, what if they came and took me away? Would that worry you?
Yes, I would be worried if they took you away, because they come for a lot of black people. We had people staying with us, and they had to run and hide in the mountains because immigration was after them. We were really worried. My mom was crying because she felt really bad.
I ask what they think motivates support for the sentencia. That's when another senior, Yaise Cuevas, chimes in. Dominicans are very racist, she says. The way we abuse Haitians, always asking for their papers and mistreating them. I ask if they think other countries should get involved in the issue of the sentencia or leave it alone. All the countries in the world should know about this, they say. The country most affected is weighing in. Haitian officials are scheduled to meet with their Dominican counterparts for talks starting on Tuesday. For The World, I'm Amy Bracken, Barahona, the Dominican Republic.
Amy has profiled four different people affected by the citizenship ruling in the Dominican Republic. You can find those profiles at PRI.org. The concept of citizenship and how it's given was quite different back in the 1940s when a boy named Eusebio was born in Mozambique in southern Africa. Mozambique was a colony of Portugal back then, and that boy, Eusebio, would become a top soccer star, but not as a Mozambican. Lisbon was, for all intents and purposes, Eusebio's capital, so he played for Portugal and was its greatest athlete ever. And today, Portugal mourns Eusebio, who died yesterday of a heart attack. The world soccer guy William Troop is here with me. So give us a sense of Eusebio's greatness. It really comes down to, I guess, the 1966 World Cup, right? It was his tournament.
Although he didn't win it, which was the great tragedy is too strong a word, but it was too bad for Eusebio. That was the peak of his career in many ways. He was the top scorer of that tournament with 9 goals. And he went down in history for this one game specifically in which North Korea, of all teams, was winning 3-0. They were, you know, total underdogs. And Eusebio was, in shock with the rest of his teammates. Then he came back. He scored 4 goals in that game to top North Korea and go on to the semifinals of that tournament, where they lost to the eventual champions of the world in 1966, which was England, the host.
Now, in 1966, was Pelé playing for Brazil at that point?
Yes, and one of the teams that Eusebio and Portugal beat on the way to the semifinals was Brazil, and Pelé was part of that team. So soccer fans today talk a lot about who's the greatest player, Cristiano Ronaldo, who was also Portuguese, or Leo Messi from Argentina. Well, Pelé and Eusebio were the Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi of their time. And during that tournament, Pelé said they became friends for life.
Now, William, you and I were talking only recently about the spate of racial abuse and epithets thrown around the soccer pitch, especially in Europe. Did Eusebio take the brunt of any of that kind of thing when he was coming up as a player in Europe in the 60s?
Oh, yeah, he did. I mean, he said several times in interviews that he was subjected to a lot of verbal abuse. But he also said that he thought black players should shrug it off, which is not, you know, what a lot of black players out there today would say, but he had this view that, you know, you should do your talking with your skills on the field.
One thing that really struck me in the obituaries about Eusebio, Portugal's strongman Antonio Salazar basically called him intangible cultural heritage, you know, a national treasure. So that made Eusebio unable to leave Portugal and pursue a big salary somewhere else. It just struck me as such a contrast with the multi-million euro salaries and trades of today. It almost seems quaint.
Yeah, and another quaint thing about it that goes right hand in hand with that is that, you know, Portugal claimed them as a country, but also one of Portugal's more historic teams, Benfica, claimed Eusebio as its icon. And so he played for 15 years for the same team, something that, you know, very few players do today because they can change teams and get more money somewhere else. He did leave after the dictatorship of Salazar and came to play here in the U.S. And in fact, he played here in Boston, where he came back last September. I actually saw him. Mm. He was at Gillette Stadium where Portugal played Brazil. And Pelé and Eusebio came to that game and went out and shook hands with all the players together. And I was just a few feet away. I saw that. And, you know, you could tell that Eusebio was not in great shape physically. But also, you could tell he was in his element. He really loved it.
And could you also tell that the young soccer players were clearly recognizing what he meant and what he symbolizes to the game?
Yes, and especially, I mean, he and Pelé shook the hand of Neymar, who is one of the up-and-coming Brazilian players now. And, I mean, you could see Neymar and the other players just beaming at having the honor to meet these two guys.
The World's William Troop, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Check out those 4 goals in one game by Eusebio at the 1966 World Cup. You can see the video at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Just ahead, a French venture capitalist translates American IT ingenuity back into his native language, starting with the conjugation for the verb to tweet.
Je tweet, tu tweet, il tweet, nous tweetons, vous tweetez, il tweet. It's an ER verb.
Il faut que nous tweetions. That's coming up on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston. Remember last week's headlines about al-Qaeda staging a comeback in Iraq, how major cities like Fallujah and Ramadi were falling to the jihadists? Well, it seems some local Sunni tribes switched sides and joined government forces pushing back on al-Qaeda. And there is more bad news for the jihadis from Syria. Rebel groups there have combined to attack al-Qaeda as well. Those two storylines are connected. Borzu Daragahi of the Financial Times has been reporting on both countries for years. Borzu, how closely related are the al-Qaeda branches in Iraq and Syria?
Well, you have a bunch of groups in both countries, but the group that everyone is sort of buzzing about lately is one called the Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, or the Levant, known by the acronym ISIS. And this ISIS is a very novel concept for a Islamic militant group. It's focused on two countries at once, and it is led by one person, a man named Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is in command nominally of forces in two countries, in Iraq and in Syria. And, you know, this is the one group that many people have been very worried about. It's got a sort of the trappings of a government. When it takes over a town, it begins painting buildings black and putting its sign, its logo, so to speak, on government buildings. It sees itself as running territory once it captures it, rather than merely fighting against Bashar al-Assad, which is what many of the other militant groups in Syria have been doing.
So are the ISIS foot soldiers mostly Iraqis and Syrians then?
I think that ISIS foot soldiers are mostly Iraqi and Syrians, but they include people from other Arab countries. And there are even units that include people from as far afield as Indonesia and Chechnya. This is a transnational Islamic militant phenomenon. They don't believe in national boundaries. They believe in Islam as the only authority to which to answer. And, you know, in that sense, many people in Syria, for example, many of the rebel groups see them as somewhat alien to their cause.
I mean, as far as Iraq goes, it seems the turning of the Sunni tribes against al-Qaeda, it's almost like a rerun of the Anbar Awakening in 2007. Are these, in fact, the same tribes that became allies with the U.S. back then?
Some of them are definitely. For example, you had the emir of the Dulaimi tribe, which is Anbar province's largest, over the weekend declaring that they were opposed to the presence of ISIS in their region and that people should rise up against it, sort of throwing in his lot with the government, even though there's huge tensions between the vast majority of Sunnis and the Shia-dominated government of Nouri Maliki. I mean, if this works in Iraq, Nouri Maliki he really owes a lot. He owes his skin to these Sunni tribesmen because he has not been good to them. He is, in many respects, the cause of al-Qaeda coming back to Iraq. His sectarian rhetoric, his policies, his security forces have created a fertile ground for al-Qaeda to come back into Iraq. And if these guys save his butt, so to speak, he really owes them.
Borza, you've been covering these kinds of conflicts for quite a while now. And I'm just wondering how, you know, you see something like this, it's sort of like, well, Iraq, it's a country, it's emerged from this wreckage of war, but now this. I mean, how does it affect you?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's been a little tough to see where 2014 is heading. You know, we've now had 3 straight years of very intense conflict and political turmoil throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And it seems like 2014 is heading south really quickly. I was just in Beirut for the holidays, and I was, you know, going to breakfast to see my daughter at breakfast. And, you know, all of a sudden there was a car bombing in the middle of Beirut and a big explosion. And it just sort of brought me back to those days in Baghdad 8-9 years ago. And it makes you think about where the region is heading and how much that sensation that a bomb could go off anywhere at any moment has really spread and really pervaded so much of the region.
Borzu Daragahi of the Financial Times, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
President Obama famously promised a pivot to Asia in 2013. A few other issues got in the way, but as 2014 gets underway, there's no question that Asia, and China in particular, remain hugely important to American foreign policy. For a look ahead at what we can expect from China in the new year, we turn to Kaiser Kuo and Jeremy Goldkorn. They're in Beijing, and they cover all things China in their weekly Seneca podcast. I asked them about the recent tensions between China and Japan over those disputed Pacific islands. Beijing's unilateral creation of a new air defense zone ruffled feathers in Japan and in Washington. But Kuo and Goldkorn say they don't see this issue re-erupting anytime soon.
I'm actually cautiously optimistic about it. I think that already you've seen quite a bit of calming down just in recent weeks.
Bear in mind that despite all the screaming headlines about China and about stuff going on in the Pacific, generally cooler heads will probably prevail both in the United States and in China and in Japan. I don't see that in 2014 anybody has it in their interests to make a lot of trouble in this region.
So that air defense zone was nothing more than a speed bump, according to you guys. So take a look at this pivot to Asia by the Obama administration. How do you see this rebalancing of U.S. foreign policy, this energy of this foreign policy now?
I think it's pretty rare to meet somebody in China who doesn't see it as some species of containment, whether they're like a think tanker or just an ordinary guy on the street. But, you know, obviously as an American, I think I know what containment would actually involve, and this is not containment. But still, I think that it was kind of poorly branded when it was rolled out as the pivot. You know, if the Obama administration had really intended to be, as it said, an economic strategy primarily, then, you know, why did they showcase it with its announcement with, like, military moves, you know, stationing, I think it was like 2,500 Marines in northern Australia? It hasn't been well packaged, that's for certain, from the Chinese perspective.
Jeremy, I'm curious. I mean, what concrete forms do you think this pivot's going to take in the next 12 months?
I think that's very difficult to know. I mean, the term pivot was coined maybe more than 2 years ago when the whole situation in the Pacific and in East Asia was very different from what it is now. I don't think there's a lot of certainty from the American side what the pivot means anymore. But what I do think is a reality that people in the United States will have to get used to is that China is going to be a more robust actor in the Pacific Ocean. China's made it quite clear that that's what they intend to do. And I don't think anything the United States does will be able to stop that.
The fact is, America always has been a Pacific power, will continue to be a Pacific power. China is perfectly cognizant of that. I think that it won't take on the kind of priority that perhaps the Obama administration suggested with that phrasing. The rebalancing was the new language that they introduced after the pivot went down like a Led Zeppelin.
One issue in China that the U.S. news media have followed more and more in recent months is the environment. I mean, we read about the atrocious air quality in cities like Beijing, but also soil pollution and food safety and industrial safety. I always wonder when China's economic prowess is going to come to loggerheads with environmental realities. Do you think 2014 is going to be that year?
Well, I think it already has been the case for several years that environmental issues have been at front and center of both public awareness of issues in society and also the government. But this is not really that different from the United States or Great Britain. At times of great economic upheaval and economic development, the environment does become a big concern. And it certainly is in China.
I would say that 2013 was really the signal year for this. This may have been the turnaround year. It was the year when you really saw public opinion. I mean, because of, you know, the robustness of Chinese social media, when air pollution especially became the issue, it became something that many of my Chinese friends who didn't concern themselves so greatly with it, suddenly it became the front and center issue for them. So we're seeing actually not just increased environmental consciousness on the part of ordinary Chinese people, but also we're seeing civil society start to coalesce around this as well.
So you think 2014 might be the year that those environmental activists really start to bring some pressure to bear on the government?
Yes, I do.
Now, I don't know if you guys can answer this next question, but it's about transparency and surveillance. In China, there's little transparency, lots of surveillance. But now we know from the leaks of Edward Snowden that the U.S. has just as much, maybe more. So where does this leave China in this big global debate?
Well, it's quite complicated because, I mean, I think the big difference between China and the United States is perhaps in the United States, the surveillance is better and of higher quality. But in China, the penalties for getting caught doing something wrong are graver. Where does this leave us? I don't know. I mean, it does make it much more difficult for the United States to criticize other countries for certain practices.
Finally, I want to ask you both about Dennis Rodman. His trips to North Korea have gotten plenty of attention here in the U.S., but what's the feeling from Beijing about, you know, not just Rodman, but events in North Korea? And I'm thinking, of course, about the recent execution of Kim Jong-un's uncle, the number two man there in government.
Yeah, Jong's execution, I think that really catalyzed a lot of people here. There had been a growing sentiment among a lot of my friends here in China. The metaphor I'd often heard was that we'd raised this pit bull in the backyard and it started to bite the neighbors and make all sorts of trouble. And there's a lot of clamor now to put it down, or at least to cut ties to the border, to set it free, or, you know, to put it in the car and take it somewhere far away.
Kaiser Kuo and Jeremy Goldkorn of the Seneca podcast speaking with us from Beijing. Thanks very much for the look ahead.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Thank you, Marco.
One more quick note about China. That's a sound of 6 tons of ivory tusks and artifacts being crushed today in China. That was a first, and John Scanlon of the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species was there to witness it.
This is the first occasion on which China has chosen to crush seized ivory. It's an occasion when China can send and is sending a very powerful message, both domestically to the Chinese people and internationally, that it is not prepared to tolerate the illegal trade in elephant ivory.
Tens of thousands of elephants are killed for their tusks every year. The U.S. and Kenya have also destroyed illegal ivory stockpiles recently, but today's ivory crush is especially significant because China is the world's biggest market for elephant tusks. A sign of recovery today in the Philippines. Schools reopened in Tacloban 2 months after Typhoon Haiyan devastated the city. Another symbol of recovery is the return of some of the area's sari-sari stores. These are small, family-owned shops that sell daily items like coffee, soap, and snacks. But they're more than that. They're also gathering places where people exchange news while they finish off a soda or drink a few beers. Aurora Almendral reports on how people in Tacloban are reviving these neighborhood institutions.
Del Mayero and her granddaughter Heavenly are running a small sari-sari store by the side of the road in Tacloban. For 2 weeks after the typhoon, Yero says she was too traumatized to do much of anything. But she describes herself as a workaholic and needed to get back to work. Using boards and corrugated tin she salvaged from a ruined home, Yero cobbled together a tabletop in a makeshift kitchen.
I don't know when and how. How could I build again? I really need help.
She rinsed off some of the goods she managed to save from the storm and began selling again. On her table, she has canned sardines, instant noodles, packets of powdered milk and shampoo, and a few pots of cooked food. She says she misses her old routine, and it hurts her to think about how hard it will be to get it back. Before the storm, Yero had a coin-operated internet cafe, a small eatery, and a full sari-sari store. Her regulars were her neighbors and the workers at the seaweed processing factory across the street. It was a profitable business and a good life, she says. Now the business is a fraction of what it used to be. Many of her customers have left and others died in the storm. Everyone is struggling. Yero says the prices at her market are high. She feels bad, but she says she has no choice. She has to charge more, sometimes just to break even. Some of her regular customers ask her for small loans to buy food. She used to do that before the storm, but she can't afford it now. Yero and the hundreds of other small sari-sari store owners in Tacloban are the last link in the city's retail supply chain.
That entire chain has been pretty much, to a large extent, destroyed.
That's Mark Ruiz, who runs an organization called Happinoy. They're trying to help sari-sari stores recover from this storm. Ruiz says many of the small stores are selling looted goods or items brought in from faraway cities. And all that means high prices, like for coffee.
Just to give you a quick benchmark, a 6-peso sachet of coffee is selling for around 10 pesos. So that's almost double.
That's only 22 cents for a single serving, but it adds up for those Filipinos who don't make much anyway. He says to get the retail chain working again, they have to restore security and infrastructure every step along the way. Distributors are still reeling from the stock they lost in the looting. Delivery vehicles were destroyed and need to be replaced. Public markets and warehouses need to be repaired. And the sari-sari store owners, who live on pretty small margins in the best of times, need loans and financing. Right now, most of them are barely scraping together enough capital to make a profit. It's not that easy to pick yourself up, Yero says. It's just not that easy.
I'll try my best.
And as the delivery of relief goods winds down, sari-sari stores will have to resume their role as the neighborhood's pantry. For The World, I'm Aurora Almendral in Tacloban.
You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. French language and culture are both beloved and weirdly despised in America. But often the biggest critics of French society are the French themselves. One target of their criticism? Tech innovation, or rather the lack of tech innovation. It's not a big priority in France. The situation is so dire that many French tech innovators have taken their talents to, where else? California's Silicon Valley. That's where reporter Alison Van Diggelen caught up with some of them, and she found a common denominator, Steve Jobs.
Why is it so hard to be an entrepreneur in France, and seemingly so much easier for a French entrepreneur to succeed in the United States? Here in Silicon Valley, the French are leaving their mark. There's Pierre Omidyar of eBay fame, semiconductor pioneer Pierre Lamonde, and serial entrepreneur Philippe Ken.
Je tweet, tu tweet, il tweet, nous tweetons, vous tweetez, il tweet. It's an ER verb.
This is Jean-Louis Gasset, a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. In the 80s, he was head of Apple France. He says true innovators are often a bit mad. But in France, they need to be more than that.
To be an entrepreneur in France, you need an additional dose of madness. The rules are so onerous.
Gasset is talking about heavy government regulation and taxes of up to 75%. These, he says, force French entrepreneurs to be tenacious and to find loopholes. Legal loopholes, of course.
In France, breaking the law is a sport. It's an honor. It's a badge to find ways to cheat the rules.
Gasset had to be creative when he established Apple in France, since the government put up roadblocks to foreign competition. What's more, Silicon Valley's overheated language was abhorrent to French ears.
You know, when our dearly departed Steve Jobs came to France and make his usual brand of hyperbolic statements, people rolled their eyes. They called him crazy, fou, méprisant, arrogant, arrogant, all of which, as we know, was part of his genius.
That genius has made Steve Jobs a hero to many younger French entrepreneurs today.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à DBF.
This is a gathering of DBF, a networking group for francophones in Silicon Valley.
We should make Steve Jobs an honorary Frenchman.
Where others saw Jobs as brash, entrepreneur Jean Forge considered him stylish, detail-oriented.
Steve Jobs was very French in his approach, because he was seeing technology through the eyes of somebody who studied fonts, characters, writing, on the detail it had to be perfect.
Forge says it's elegance, not money, that drives French entrepreneurs.
It has to be beautiful, quelque chose qui vous parle. It speaks to you affectively.
But Forge adds that even among the open-minded French entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, there's still some insularity.
Where the French people gathered, they call that the frog pond. I want every day to have my steak pommes frites to leave the way French clear.
Not surprisingly, Silicon Valley has dozens of French eateries. I met with Susan Lucas-Conwell at the Douce France Café. She's married to a Frenchman and says the French view business failure differently. Whereas in Silicon Valley, it's a badge of honor. In France,
that's one of the non-dits, or the things that you never talk about.
To make matters worse, according to Lucas-Conwell, French government officials are expert at the business put-down.
You'll hear the administration calling entrepreneurs les patrons voyous. Voyous is a thug.
That's pretty strong. Another manifestation of the anti-entrepreneurial culture in France. And just think, the word entrepreneur is French. So while French innovators struggle Sisyphus-like up a steep montagne, they can move here to Silicon Valley and feel an optimistic wind at their back. Here's Jean-Louis Gasset.
We Silicon Valley people tend to think that we run the world. And I think it's a wonderful thing. We are the melting pot's melting pot.
Another French transplant calls Silicon Valley the Mecca, a place where they can thrive even if they first fail. And if they're really lucky, they get to push that rock to the top of the mountain and enjoy the glory. That's the Silicon Valley promise, anyway. For The World, I'm Alison Van Diggelen in Silicon Valley, California.
Tomorrow we'll hear from France about an experimental college that's training students to become computer programmers and upsetting traditional French educators. Now, sometimes to find opportunity, you need a change of scenery, like those French innovators who went to Silicon Valley that we just told you about, or like these musicians who left the Caribbean for Europe. Their music has a bit of a reggaeton edge to it, but the band Cuenta y Tambu is not from Panama or Puerto Rico. It's from the island of Curaçao. Cuenta y Tambu means stories and drums in Curaçao's Papiamento language, but founder Roel Callister, who's from the island, didn't start the band there. You see, Curaçao is a Dutch protectorate, so there's a regular flow between Curaçao and Amsterdam, and that's where the band, which goes by the acronym KIT, formed 9 years ago. Now, though, Callister and Kit are back in Curaçao, where they're combining the island's traditional rhythms with European electronic music. You can hear that mix of old-style singing and new-style beat on this track, La Señora. If you're in New York next weekend and want to see Curaçao dance music live, KIT will be taking the stage as part of Global Fest, playing music from their debut U.S. recording, Tambutronic. We'll leave you with one more taste of it, a track called Light Switch. What better way to raise a temperature on this frigid day than to get the heart pumping and the feet moving, right? From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Join us again tomorrow. Your challenge, I take it. I jump, you know. Can't beat me, no. Collecting me, glory, and this star. Me head start, be burning, I miss ya. Can't keep on talking, this is star. Light switch me, Captain Kalista. I'm out, I'm out. Light switch me, Captain Kalista. Show me where your light switches. Show me where your light switches. Show me where your light switches. Show me where your light switches.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Anne Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.